And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and today we are joined again by our co-host, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm doing well. I'm looking forward to talking with you today about climate reparations, what they are, and whether there is a moral obligation from the global north to the global south for dealing with them.
So, Mariah, recently in Glasgow, Scotland, was the COP26, the Conference of the Parties, which, by all accounts, was mixed in its results. But that sheds light on some other ideas that we want to talk about. And in particular, what I think is useful for people to know about is an article by a guy named David Wallace Wells, who in the last couple of years wrote a book called The End of Humanity. Is basically a book that scared the life out of a lot of climate activists, basically saying that we're all gonna die. But he's written another article, which is actually quite thought provoking from my perspective. And what I'd like to do is kind of set up what he's saying, and then maybe we can go back through and chop up some of the ideas that are involved in it. He makes the point that climate change, right? This is an article called The Case for Climate Reparations. It's published in New York Magazine, and we'll put up a link to it. But we often talk about climate change as being a environmental emergency, a health emergency, all these kinds of emergencies that climate change is. He makes the case that climate change is a moral catastrophe, a moral wrong that's being perpetrated in the world, mostly by people in the global north, right? And we don't have to rehearse again all of the things that we've talked about often about how devastating climate change will be for people who live in island nations, or people who live in sub-Saharan Africa, already a famine in Madagascar, I think, that's climate related.
Floods in Bangladesh.
The floods in Bangladesh, yeah. Yes. So the idea that climate change is a moral catastrophe is based on the following idea that, according to Wells, 60% of the carbon in the atmosphere today, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, was put up there in the last 38 years. Right? It's within the lifetime of an average American who's 38 years old, 60% of the carbon. And 90% of the carbon that is in the air was put in the air during the lifetime of Joseph Robinette Biden. So we are, with pretty good knowledge right now, adding huge amounts of carbon dioxide into the air. And we know we're doing it, and it's happening real time now. It's not some historical thing that James Watt did in 1726. And that leads you to the idea that the people in the United States and in the global north, that is to say Europe, Japan, China, whatnot, have done all this damage, and it's all going to be suffered by the people in the global south. And that brings up the concept of some sort of debt being owed from the global north writ large, however you want to define that, to the global south, somehow, defined, right? There's some moral debt that's owed. And then, of course, what happens, that gets translated into this concept of reparations. There's somehow, the United States, reparations, the word reparations has a pretty clear history. It relates to slavery, right? But in this context, we're talking about reparation to the future and all the people in the global south who are suffering from what we have done over the last 50 years here in the global north, and putting all the hurt on those people, right? So what is that?
There's a really great map that helps you visualize this. It's called the Carbon Tracker Map. And hopefully we can share a link to that too. And it basically, it shows a map of the world with all of the continents on it. And when you click on the tab that says carbon emissions, it distorts the size of each continent or country based on how much of the emissions they're responsible for. And so, of course, you know, the United States gets huge, right? You know, it's and then Africa shrinks down to very little. And then you go click on the, areas that will be most impacted by climate change, and Africa gets huge and the United States shrinks down to very little. So it really gives you this nice visualization of what happens, what it looks like in terms of who's made the pollution and who will suffer from the pollution.
Exactly. Exactly. And what Wells talks about is a calculation, which you can argue about, and it's not really meant to be serious, right? But that in the atmosphere already, there are several trillion tons of carbon dioxide that have been put up there from us all driving our cars around here in the quote unquote global north. And that if you assign a dollar value to all those tons of carbon in the air, even at $100 a ton, which is nominally what the social cost of carbon is, as designated by most reasonable people, it turns out that there's $250 trillion worth of value that could say is owed to the people who live in the global south. $250 trillion is a lot of money. Even Joe Manchin wouldn't like that much money. And that, and the United States would owe $50 trillion to try and make up for the damage that it has done by putting all that carbon dioxide in the air based on these sort of naive calculations. That's, so now you can argue about that. That's silly. Maybe it is silly. Maybe it's not precise enough, but it gives you a scale of the kinds of damage that's being perpetrated on people who don't have any ability to protect themselves from it. So then Wells goes on and talks about really this climate debt has to be thought of in terms of restoration. That is to say, taking the carbon dioxide out of the air that the global north, the United States, has put into the air, right? That restoration to get the CO2 levels down is a moral obligation. And you can think of it that there's a lot of talk, even in the United States, that it's going to be net zero emissions by 2050, right? Or sooner or whatever, pick your favorite number, that basically the United States is going to stop emitting carbon dioxide by some few decades in the future, right? But just the emissions are the annual additions to the stock of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So if you say, I'm a good boy now, I am not going to put any more emissions in the air, that still leaves a huge amount of carbon dioxide floating around that would need to be taken out. Right? And even if the United States in the North does get to a zero emission kind of status quo, you're still going to lose all the Pacific Islands, right? You're still going to have all this suffering, right? And so you can't just say, we are morally clean if we stop our emissions, because all the stuff that's already been put up in the air by us is going to continue to cause suffering in other places. Well, there you go. That is a tough thing to chew on, especially given the idea that removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere is really a contentious topic. So let's switch gears again. We've heard a lot of talk about net zero, how companies are going to be net zero, the United States is going to be net zero, the whole world is going to be net zero by 2050. It's a very nice turn of phrase, but as someone said, the net zero, the net part of that is doing a lot of work, because all of those ideas assume that there will be a technology that can cheaply and effectively take lots and lots of carbon dioxide out of the air, right? It's either by trees, right? We're going to plant a trillion trees, which is fine until you say, what country are we going to plant a trillion trees in? It's not going to be Manhattan, right? It's going to be some other place that gets the trillion trees, right? But then the whole concept of net zero is kind of a way to dodge the bullet and to say, we're going to think up a bunch of great technology and put it all in place. And by 2050, we'll be net zero. Trust me, everything's going to be great, right? And that, I think, has given net zero a bad name. In particular, carbon dioxide removal, because as I said, a lot of people are proposing that we plant a bunch of trees, right? And we don't have space for that, right? But the other idea is to develop a technology to remove carbon dioxide from the air. And that turns out right now there's a little company, I think it's called Climeworks. Have you heard of that place in Switzerland, mm-hmm. someplace where they take out like 1,000 pounds of carbon dioxide directly out of the air by having various kinds of chemical and energy processes. And it costs like $1,000 to get a ton of carbon dioxide out of the air, which is mind-bogglingly expensive. It's technically possible, right, to do this. And the question is, who's going to spend all that money to develop that technology and take all that carbon dioxide out of the air over the next 200 years as we try to remove the carbon dioxide and get us back down below 350 ppm, back down to what it was when George Washington was stomping around, right, which was 287 parts per million.
Well, and to put a finer point on that, even if we do have full carbon out of the air, the carbon capture and sequestration technology has a lot of question marks and issues with it, because you're taking it and storing it underground. And who's to say that it's actually going to solve the problem and not just create a bigger problem down the road with earthquakes or, you know, having it come back up all at once? I mean, that's, you know, this a stretch, but, you know, there's issues, unknown issues about that technology, and whether it would actually solve the problem and be safe. So, but money aside,
the technology is
a great solution. Yeah.
But I think David Wallace Wells is saying is that you can, with enough money, you can figure out a way to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. You need a lot of power, you need a lot of solar panels, all this kind of stuff, but it's possible. Real question is, how long would it take to remove that carbon dioxide, and what do you get for it, right? So he's making the case that this carbon dioxide removal technology, this actively taking carbon dioxide out of the air, it cannot be used as an excuse to slow walk emissions reductions, right? You still have to shut down Exxon today, right, and stop putting any more carbon dioxide up in the air. But then if you do that and you begin to try and remove some carbon dioxide from the air, what you do is you change the timelines so that now you're aiming for a world that has less carbon dioxide in it. You're paying money, the reparations money, this $50 trillion, so to speak, is used to take carbon dioxide out of the air. But now you have kind of a century timeline, 100 years to do this, right? And you can provide more equity. You're protecting the people in the third world on those islands that would be lost if you didn't take the carbon dioxide out. That makes sense. It's a very deep article. There's a lot of interesting points, and I highly urge you to read it. But I think what the guy's saying is that even if you get to net zero, there's still going to be 400 parts per million of CO2 in the air, and that's damaging to most of the world's, you know, poor population. You're morally obligated to reduce that 400 ppm down to whatever you can. And that's where your money should be going, the reparation money, in quotation marks, to develop the technology and pay for its use to get the 400 back down to a lower number. And that gives everybody some breathing space. You know, left-leaning climate hawks like myself can say, yeah, if we did that, then we wouldn't be talking about 2030 so much.
Yeah, so I think it's a really interesting line of thought, and I, to a large degree, agree with it. I mean, we certainly we've been dumping pollution and shortening the lifespans and the, you know, the sort of quality of life for many people for far too long, and it's not fair, right? It's not okay, especially when we won't suffer as much as these people whose lives we've really put in danger, or livelihoods we've put in danger. But there's a challenge, of course, with the idea of a moral imperative to do this. Our country is not set up to act on moral imperatives, right? You know, a moral imperative to help out the Kiribati and Maldives and all of these low-lying Pacific Island nations that will be lost to climate change, that doesn't get the politicians voted in, right? I mean, so it's, you know, it's nice to talk about it in an article, but what's the reality of it? How do you actually make something like this happen?
I take your point. I mean, it's almost like wishing that everyone would be nice to each other, right? And effectively, yeah, that's what it comes down to, right? You say, what kind of people do we want to be? Do we want to be a kind of people that, one of the questions in the article poses, it says to a person in the North, does someone who lives in the south of the equator, right, is that a real person to you? Or is that just a number? Right. And once you say it's a real, it's really hard. I agree with you. I mean, it's not, moralizing is not, doesn't get you many votes. Right.
Well, and of course, the other problem with moralizing is it's also, my morals might be different than your morals. And who's to say whose morals are right? Right. So there might be something that you prioritize in your moral world that is completely unrelated or comes right up in the face of something like this, and it makes it an obstacle. Your belief system becomes an obstacle to put aside in order to embrace something like climate reparations. And so, the idea of sort of prescribing moral angles to climate can be really, really tricky. And again, I'm not saying that I disagree with the idea for climate reparations. I certainly think that, we owe it to the people whose lives we have, curtailed or made it difficult. But it's just a hard sell. It's a hard angle to take with it.
I mean, I can easily imagine some kind of, what is it, Ayn Rand? Randian sort of neoliberal saying, well, no, I mean, everyone has to take care of themselves. If you're unlucky enough to be born south of the equator, well, that's your fate, right? And that you're perfectly morally justified to not worry about that. I agree. I mean, I you would think that if seeing bad things happen to other people was a motivating force for U.S. politics, we would have solved most of the problems by now, right?
Well, but even from the, let's take the, from the perspective of not necessarily neoliberal capitalism, but the person who works for a coal mine and who's saying don't shut down, if you shut down this coal mine, I can't put food on the table for my family because I don't have a job anymore. And this is all the only world I've ever known. Mm-hmm. And so it's really hard for me to, be concerned about people in Maldives when, if you do this to me, my family's going to die, or my family's going to fall on hard times, right? So, that's, again, I'm not making excuses for things, no, but
that's an interesting sort of point.
Flip side of the coin.
I mean, that sort of, in everything that I've said, I've sort of blanket applied everyone who lives in the United States versus everyone who lives south of the equator. But you're saying, my response to the coal miner guy is, even within the United States, there's grotesque unfairnesses about who's going to get to survive, right? Yeah. Who's going to be, Joe Manchin will still have his yacht, even when bad things are happening to all other people, right? In the United States, much less. So, yeah.
And I'm not saying, I think we should shut down the coal mines. I definitely do. And I think there are pathways for the people that are in coal mines, to, having a life that's not full of, black lung, for one, but just to kind of provide the flip side of the coin there, there's always perspective.
I appreciate that. And I guess what I would say is that, dear listener, if you get a chance, go read this article. It's The Case for Climate Reparations. It's in the New York Magazine, as distinct from the New Yorker, right? This is the New York Magazine. It was published in early November. It's quite thought-provoking. It talks a lot about carbon dioxide removal, which again has a bunch of moral stuff hanging off it. And Mariah, you quite rightly you know, sort of pop the balloon of, you know, whose morals are we talking about, right? And that's a whole big discussion. But it's worth taking a read if you get a chance, dear listener, because all this stuff is for real now. So, Mariah, what we'll do is I'll put up links to this stuff on the blog at massclimateaction.org/blog. If you have a question about the podcast or suggestions or things we ought to talk about, send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what we should be thinking about. You're probably listening to this show on your smartphone using Stitcher, one of the modern podcast distribution apps. There's so many of them now. You can find us on almost all of them. Please ask your friends to listen to us on their favorite modern podcast distribution app. I want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. I want to close where we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. And because of that, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade, and maybe take carbon out of the atmosphere over the next century or so. Anyway, under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon that respects environmental justice communities. So, Mariah, thank you so much for being here. Interesting discussion.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.